Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Runa is the world's finest magazine of cycling and cycling culture. Established in 2006, Runa interviews the world's biggest cycling names and covers the world's biggest cycling races. Visit our website at runa.cc and subscribe to support our in-depth features, long reads, independent journalism, stunning photography and immersive cycling coverage. I'm Edward Pickering, I'm the editor of Runa, and this is Runa Conversations. We've been a bit quiet on Runa Conversations in the last few weeks. We got a bit busy on Runa Live, the best ever edition of our annual show, which just gets bigger and better every year. And we've also just gone to press on the last magazine of 2023, which is an absolute cracker. But we're back now, and we're going to put together a special series of podcasts through to the end of the year, which are going to include some of the interviews and stage talks we did at Runa Live. We had so many amazing guests, we felt it would be interesting for our podcast listeners to enjoy some of the atmosphere of the show, or if they're actually there, to relive some of the best moments, or even to catch up on anything they missed. We're going to kick off the series with a stage talk I did with Geraint Thomas on the final day of the show. Thomas is, as I point out in my introduction, one of the greatest cyclists Great Britain has ever produced. Of course, he's a Tour de France winner, so he's international cycling royalty. But what I've always found interesting about him is his versatility. He has won Olympic gold medals on the track, week-long stage races, and even classics with an E3 place win in 2015. He's also famously laid back and personable, and my perception is that fame has not at all left a mark on him. He's got two very successful podcasts up and running, What's Occurring, which he hosts with Ineos teammate Luke Rowe, and the Geraint Thomas Cycling Club with journalist Tom Fordyce. And he's just got a great new book out, Great Rides According to G, about his favourite rides and a lot of backstory to go with each one. It's a great Christmas present for the cyclist in your life, along with, of course, a Runa subscription. So, without further ado, here's our stage talk from Runa Live 2023, according to G. Hello, Runa Live 2023. Welcome to day three of the show. I'm Edward Pickering, I'm the editor of Runa Magazine, a hollow husk of a man after three solid days of Runa Live. I hope you've all had as good a time as I have. So, joining me on stage today is a Tour de France winner, one of the greatest cyclists Great Britain has ever produced, Geraint Thomas.
Thank you.
How's your Runa Live going so far?
Oh, it's been busy, to be honest. Well, the last 2 weeks hasn't helped, to be fair. So when my alarm's going off at 6:30, I was like, why is my alarm going off? And I was like, oh yeah, great, I'm going to the Runa.
And so, what have you done so far today?
I went, mate, I don't even know. I've been on here with Nico. We had to do I didn't really realise it was a live podcast. I've got a podcast, by the way.
So it's on my list of stuff to cover. So.
Cool. And then, what did we do there? I've been to Pinerello Cask, back here. Had a pizza in the middle of it. But it's been good, yeah. It's nice to come and see how passionate people are as well. Because you never get to do that really, you know, at a race. You kind of, well, you know everyone enjoys racing and stuff. But yeah, it's good to see the love for cycling, really, yeah.
And have you seen the portrait that's been made of you by the Puncher street artists out of the entrance?
Yeah, fair play. Off, all out a little tiny...
22,000 little dots.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's impressive.
I bumped into Geraint in the green room earlier on just to say hello.
And over beer and pizza, you said you'd had a massive off-season. So just clarify for the benefit of those of us who may not know what you mean. How massive has your off-season been?
Well, it's been massive in every way, really. I've had 5 weeks off the bike since the Vuelta. I sort of ridden a little bit in between there. But yeah, 5 weeks totally off. I did an event in Ibiza, which was quite heavy, which it's pretty obvious when you think about it, isn't it? When you think of Ibiza. But I didn't expect it. I thought it'd just ride and, you know, a few meals and whatever. But that was quite heavy. And then come back to Cardiff, and I haven't been back to Cardiff since Christmas, maybe less than 2 weeks. So, you know, you meet everyone, and as soon as you meet a mate, it's like, oh, we'll go out for dinner and a couple of bottles of wine later. It's quite a big night. So it's been like that, really. And then we was in Bluestone. It's kind of similar to Centre Parks. It's in West Wales. Was there with the kids, so that was even more tiring. So yeah, I'm just looking forward to getting back on the straight and narrow, really.
You seem to have established a rhythm that works for you, where whatever you are doing, you do it properly.
Yeah, because kind of like these days is a lot of data we were speaking about earlier. Like there's so many, everything's measured. Like when you're on the bike, it's obviously measured, power cranks and whatever, heart rate. And then, you know, you've got all these sleeping apps now, and then nutrition and all this and that. So I can do it and commit to it, but I still don't wear the sleeping ring or anything. Like it's pretty obvious if you have a bad night's sleep, isn't it?
You've got a child, Garen.
Yeah, exactly. So I have like a big build up to a big goal, and then I sort of had a little blowout. You continue the season, you do your job, whatever, but then the end of season is my time to really let go, really. And I don't read anything in the news or don't follow cycling in any way. I speak to my mates, obviously, but totally switch off and then get the hunger back then, which I definitely have now. I'm just like, I really need to just ride my bike now and just have a bit of structure.
Yeah, and apart from the parties and stuff, obviously you have a family, and these days, the cycling season, you're away so much. It's actually quite important to get the family time as well, isn't it?
Most definitely, yeah. Like from March until the end of the Giro, I think I was home for about 11 days. And yeah, March to the end of May, that is. So it's a long old time away, you know, like because these days as well, like altitude camps are even more important. You know, teams are doing like longer, like 3 week stints now, and it's just getting more and more full on. And I'm kind of happy I'm at the age I am, to be honest. I don't want it to sound bad now, but I'm glad I'm not 20, but you know, with all these years in front of me. But I don't know, it's a lot more. I don't think you'll get as long a careers anymore. For sure there'll be the odd exception, but in general I think because the racing's so intense, like I think from January to October now, you know, Pogacar can, but you know, for the majority of the guys, it's hard to maintain a high level for that period with the way the racing is. But yeah, I've always kind of done that. Just big highs and very deep lows. But that works for me.
Yeah, we'll get on to the deep lows of 2023 shortly. You've been a pro for 17 seasons now, and you just signed for another two with Ineos for another 2 years, which will take your total up to 19 seasons. And you know, has that perspective on your whole career from this point of view, well, you know, how is that?
It's mad. I don't feel that old. And 37 is old for a cyclist now. I just remember when I think back to when I turned pro, and I don't know who the oldest in the team would have been, but to think like if they were 36, 37, you'd just be like, my granddad, like, you know? And now that's me. I'm kind of like, wow. Yeah, it's crazy. But I think because I'm with the younger guys all the time as well, it definitely keeps you young. Because like Max's school, for instance, now he's just started his preschool. Chatting with some of the dads at some random party. This party was insane, by the way, in Monaco. Mate, it's sick. But anyway, that's a different story. I was chatting to some of the dads, and they, you know, they're all in sort of finance and, you know, selling this and that and talking about this. And then one of them looked at me. I was kind of like, mate, I just ride a bike, and when it hurts, I just try harder. Like, so then I was like, yeah, maybe cycling has held me back a little with the whole developmental thing.
How is it bringing up a family in Monaco?
It's great, to be fair. Like, you've got your stereotypical Monaco life, which that there definitely is that side, but we're in a quieter, more residential part. You know, Max, like I said, started preschool. He absolutely loves it. He did go to a French one last year, and he hated it, just cried every day. And that's like, oh, it's nothing worse, is there? But now he loves this school, runs in there, doesn't even look back.
Your job is done.
Exactly, yeah. So that's great. My wife loves it there. She's always been a massive homing pigeon, you know, loves being in Cardiff and family, friends. But now after like 11 years away, she's like, I don't really want to move back now.
Really?
I think, yeah, with the weather and just, but we definitely will, but it's not the real world either. It's a bit like Disneyland, you know, but it is super clean, super safe. That's the main thing, the safety. you know, my wife can go out for some drinks and walk back midnight, 1 in the morning, feel fine, you know. Then outdoors for Max is great. You know, you don't have to plan anything around the weather. You just know it's going to be a nice day. So, yeah, and they're happy. That's why I extended as well.
Yeah. And is Max more understanding of what you actually do for a living now?
A little. I think at the minute it's kind of having a bit of a negative effect on him because he wants to race everywhere. So even if we're walking on a bike, you know, hopping, whatever, you've got to race. I've just started beating him, though, a few times. And it causes a few meltdowns. Like
competitive dad style? Or
yeah, well, I'm just a bit like, he's got to learn at some point, haven't he? Like, so that's interesting. But yeah, it's decent.
Yeah. So let's talk about 2023. Interesting season for you. So what was your mindset going into the year? What were your aims and targets? And how did it unfold from the start of the year?
So the main goal was the Giro. And in the back of my mind, it was like, yeah, possibly do the Vuelta after. Because I'd never done Giro Vuelta in the same year. But the main goal was the Giro. And then end of December, I had like an infection, a UTI infection, random. Couldn't find out why. Kept coming back. Cut a long story short, like till end of February, start of March, kind of found out why, sorted it out. But for that whole period of a good, yeah, 2.5 months, it was really stop-start, no consistency. And it was the first time I'd had like, you know, when you're injured and it's kind of, you know what you've got to do. You hit the physio and you get better and whatever. Whereas this was like a bit unknown. We didn't really know why it was coming back and whatever. And anyway, got that sorted. And then it was maybe 8 weeks, maybe 7 weeks till the Giro. So it was full gas, trying to stay positive, full gas to the Giro. And that went the way it did.
That seems quite late to, you know, to get onto peak form for your target.
It was. It was by far the most, I don't know about underprepared, but it was the most sort of like to the limit where I was like, I don't actually know how good I could be here, like on the start line. And it turns out that very first time trial, I lost 16 seconds to Roglic and I ended up losing by 15 in the end. I'm not saying it's all down to that TT, but it's kind of like, well, if I just had that couple of weeks extra, who knows? But that's the way it goes, isn't it? And that's, you know, I did everything I could at the time with what was happening. So and that's kind of what took the edge off the disappointment of coming second as well, just coming from where I had, really.
Yeah, having been third in the Tour de France the year before, and you have targeted the Giro before and had a bit of bad luck along the way. So were you confident you were going to be able to put in a good performance?
I was, but I don't know if it was a bit, you know, as athletes as well, you get quite delusional sometimes. You know, you kind of like talk yourself, no matter how it's going, you kind of like always, no, it'll be okay in the end. And you kind of just that attitude of, I don't know, like being ultra positive, I guess, and just sort of confidence in what you're doing, knowing that, no, I've done X, Y, and Z, I can still be good. So that was kind of my attitude. So after everything that happened, I knew there was still a chance, but I knew I was up against it. And then obviously the lineup was strong, you know, with Remco and Roglic and everybody else, obviously. Teo was going really well, teammate. So I knew it was going to be super hard. And I was kind of like, well, after what I've had, it's going to be harder. But that is what it is, you know. You can't affect that now. So crack on and see what happens.
And how was the feeling in the team? Because Teo, you know, came off the back of winning the Tour of the Alps before the Giro. And I guess there was a joint leadership strategy going. Was the feeling in the team good? Was everything kind of clear?
Yeah, it was great. And to be fair to Teo, he was always behind me. If I needed him, he would have stepped up and helped, even though, like I say, it was a rocky road to that point. But I think the good thing, though, is everyone could see the progression as well. So from, well, down under when I just basically had to get around it. You know, if I'd been in Europe, there's no way the team would have put me in, but because I was down there, I did it. Then after that, it was Catalonia, so it was quite a big gap. And from Catalonia to the Alps, I'd made quite a big step forward. And I think the whole team could see that. You know, we'd been on camp together. They could see me getting better through the camp. So I think that was the main thing. Like everyone else sort of gained confidence from that as well. Then, and they all became as delusional as me probably, but yeah.
Yeah. That first time trial stage, quite astonishing really. I mean, that many of the GC favourites were quite grouped together, apart from Evenepoel, who put in a really good day that day. What were your thoughts after that day?
It wasn't a major surprise, to be honest, because we kind of knew he's got that in him, like one massive big day, one big hit. But to put it together over 3 weeks was always like, you don't really know. But yeah, the way he went there, like I think he put 20 odd seconds into Pipo maybe. Like I think for Club 10, it was close to 16 minutes. Like it was unreal. And there was a couple of corners as well. So proper, similar to a dual carriageway circuit. You know what I mean? It was unbelievable how quick he went. But yeah, everyone was a bit like, whoa. But at the same time, you're like, 3 weeks is a long way away, so we'll see how it goes. And yeah, as it turns out, he ends up getting COVID and whatever anyway.
Yeah, and the race progressed actually pretty well for you, didn't it? I mean, you stayed out of trouble, you were there for the main moments. It's quite a quiet first week on the GC maybe, and then there was that stage, very punchy stage to Fossombrone, I think it was, where you, Roglic and Teo actually got away. Mm. And that was the first time people got the idea, hang on, maybe Evenepoel's not the guy, maybe it's these three guys.
Yeah, I think the weather had a big part to play in that first bit as well. There was one stage, I don't know the name of it now, it was like an uphill finish, it's supposed to be the first battle, and that was a strong headwind, and it's kind of like, when it's such a strong headwind like that, and it's a 10, 15K climb, like, where are you going to go? So it kind of neutralised the race. But then this climb, I think it's Cappuccino climb it was called. I was actually surprised, to be honest, because that's probably my least favourite type of climb, like a sort of hit, like, you know, it was only 5 minutes or something, it was quite short. But yeah, to get over the top, and Teo had just, I'm sure he was attacking me, but he had just got me over the top, which is fine. And
was that deliberate on your part to just...
Yeah, give him a bit of hope. But then, no, we're all good, by the way, I'm just joking. But Roglic was in front, Teo just got across to him, and I was a big gap. And I think that's the deepest I've gone all year, like just to close that last little bit. But the difference when you do close compared to if you didn't was just massive. And that, yeah, that was the big thing. And me and Teo just sat on him on the descent because you couldn't really give a turn anyway. And then a little bit chop off. And so, yeah, that was a big boost of confidence. That's when I was like, oh, actually, yeah, this is game on now.
And how did the rest of the race progress for you?
Good. You know, the long TT almost won that. That was less than a second. That was frustrating, especially because like visor got steamed up. I had to throw that. Radio was bit in and out, and it always seems to be something happening, even in a time trial. And then took the jersey then, because Remco went home, which was nice. Well, not nice that he went home, but nice to take the jersey.
It was nice for him to get a rest. I mean, he was sick.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And then that was great, leading the race, you know, especially after, because 21 was probably the lowest, probably the worst, well, season I've had, really. Like, build up to the tour was the best season I had. Then the tour went to pot on stage three, popped my shoulder out, and then, I don't know, a bit of mental, a bit of everything, it just didn't go well. And then went to the Olympics, crashed out of that. I know the contract negotiations weren't great. So that was a really rough time. So then this year then, to take the jersey and then have that week, it was almost like going back 5 years to when I won the tour, and all the boys, you know, real good atmosphere. Everyone was riding really well, 100% behind me, and amazing. And then we did that bloody TT up some stupid hill.
Like, yeah, sorry about that. I mean, we'll punch that bruise.
Mountain, not hill.
We'll punch that bruise in a minute. But first of all, Teo crashed out, and that doesn't suit the team. I mean, I know that, you know, he was possibly in the best form he's ever been in, and an unlucky crash on a pretty innocuous descent. What was the atmosphere in the team after that?
Yeah, everyone was disappointed, but after a day, you know, once you start the next day, it's almost like you don't forget about it, but well, you do as well, in a way, like in a harsh way, but you have to be focused on what you're doing, and it just kind of just moves on. But it was a massive blow to lose him, because as I say, if he had still been in the race, it would have been totally different, because we would have had, you know, two cards to play. We could have definitely done something different, which we were both up for, you know, racing a bit like that. But yeah, unfortunately, it was a UAE guy. He crashed in front of me. I just basically landed on him, and then Teo was behind me and Pavel behind him, and they both crashed. They were hurt quite badly. I had nothing on me, a little scuff on my shorts. But so it was mad, the difference, because he'd obviously had he broke something. I don't know what now. He had to have surgery, and he's just back on the bike now. So really bad injury. So yeah, I was lucky, he had really bad luck, and the team were down for a bit, but as I say, sort of rallied, and there was also a bit of COVID in the peloton as well. Everyone was stressing about that. My family couldn't come out, they were going to come to the rest day, and so then they're a bit like, at least I get to rest now anyway. So it was a lot going on. Like, we lost Pipo early on because of COVID as well, and then we lost Pavel a few days after that because he had a few crashes along the way. So it was eventful, but morale and everything still was really positive.
The mountains in the final week were huge, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. And luckily, so it's Puccio and Swifty, who aren't really necessarily, well, they weren't the strongest climbers in the team, but they upped their game massively. So that meant the other two got, because there's only five of us left, Tepluski and Timon, and they were flying as well. So the four of them did the job of eight, you know, and it was insane. And it is, a lot of it is all the mentality as well, and really wanting to, you know, dig in for your mates, really. And it definitely brought us together and, yeah, bonded us even more, I'd say.
And the rivals that emerged at the end, it was clearly Roglic, you and Almeida, you know, you were a level above everyone else. And really, you until stage 20, it seemed that you had the upper hand on those other two riders.
Yeah, I felt like I definitely had it on Almeida. It was the one day when Roglic crashed. Looking back now, I was like, maybe I should have just... So I wanted to race for that stage, so I didn't... Once I caught Almeida, I went quite hard to try and get rid of him. And he managed to stay there. Maybe if I just kept going a bit... You know, you think all these things now. But if I had tried to keep going and just think about getting to the top as quick as I could, might have popped him, and then I would have had the stage anyway. But instead, I sort of backed off a bit, used him. We rode together a little, but it was always a bit like cat and mouse a bit. So we didn't gain as much time on Roglic as what we could have. Then he beat me in the sprint. Yeah, and then, you know, fast forward like a week or whatever, and you lose by 15 seconds. You're like, maybe if I had... But that's bike racing, isn't it? And at the time, you do what you kind of think you should do.
Is he good to talk about the time trial?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so what's your perspective on that time trial now? What was your thoughts going into the... How was your mindset? Did you feel okay?
I felt good. Like, I knew Roglic was strong, though, because there was a few times when he attacked the day before, and the day before that was... It was hard, for sure, but, you know, to win a Grand Tour is not easy, is it? So, you know, you expect it to be hard. So I was in a good frame of mind. I was feeling good. No difference the other days, really. But looking back, we were a bit too much focused on, like, the weight as well. Like how... Because normally in, you know, a five-hour stage, doesn't matter how heavy you are at the start, because that's all just glycogen and store, you know, it's stuff, water retention, all this jazz. So when you get to the end, you're about 1.5-2 kilos lighter anyway, even by fueling loads and not thinking about it. But then for this TT, it was like, I think it was 5.5K, like 15%, which is steep and long. And we didn't even ride it. We couldn't recon it. We drove up there in the cars in the morning. But yeah, anyway, going into it, I think it was probably a little dehydrated. But yeah, it was just a brutal climb. And there weren't any fans allowed in the middle part because it was too narrow and steep. And so that was weird. There was a motorbike behind as well because the cars couldn't go up there. With the DS sat on the back of the motorbike with a radio, and it was just, yeah, unique for sure.
Yeah, it looked weird. It looked like just you're out for a ride because there's, you know, it's like a ride through a forest on your own.
Yeah, it was. And that was weird. Like, you know, in such a big race, no fans and just, you're still focused and stuff. But I don't know, I would have preferred, even though they would have been Slovenians, just the atmosphere would have just... Not that Roglic is Slovenian,
very
so
careful.
His fans is what I mean, yeah. Nothing wrong with Slovenians.
Matej Mohoric was there the other day. You know, careful what you say about Slovenians.
Yeah, I think it would have added more to it. I'm not saying the result would have changed, but I don't know, it was a very surreal race. And then I heard on the radio like that he had a mechanical or something, and I saw a time check. Like, we had a stationary guy as well for an extra time check, and I don't know what it was at that point, maybe 10 seconds, and you're thinking, oh... But to be honest, then, I kind of knew I'd lost it because I was like, I could just feel my legs going. And I'd had bicarb in the morning, like drunk it, which I used to do on the track, but never really done on the road because I retain fluids easily. So if I have bicarb, I'll be 2-3 kilos heavier the next day, just purely from fluid retention. And I'll take a day or two to sweat it out. So I'd never really take it. But then obviously, you know, stage 20, it doesn't matter if you're heavy the next day. So I had it, and it's just a different feeling. And there was probably a mistake just to do that because, well, yeah, it's just different. You don't really have that grunt. You don't feel like you're just forcing it. It's just more like your legs are just going to jelly. And it was horrible, actually. Even then, getting into the fans the last sort of 2K, just being like, oh, I could just feel like I'm really not going anywhere now. But you have to get to the finish. And he got to the finish, and I just knew Marco Maswany was there to catch me and push me up the last, after the finish, obviously. But, like, get me to the tent or whatever. Then, as I was getting to the tent, Dupluski and Timon, who were both top 10 as well at the time, so they walk out the tent, so they had waited there to watch it. And I just looked at them, and they were just like, looked through me almost, and just like got out of the way. And then I was like, oh, I've definitely lost it. And I was sat in that tent. I could just hear, like, Jumbo were next door. I could hear them all celebrating. And I could hear all, like, the Slovenian fans. And I was just like, oh, mate, like, I would just rather be anywhere else in the world right now. But you just sat there. Yeah, you're just gutted, aren't you? You're just like, poor. But... Like I said in my podcast, if I was like fifth and was getting better and then ended up second, then you can kind of accept that, but the fact that I was leading and then to just boom lose it on the last day made it even worse.
It's to your credit, you faced the TV cameras, you seem to deal with it pretty well under the circumstances.
Yeah, kind of like, you know, I knew I had to go and congratulate Roglic and, you know, the team, even though they did sod all. But and then obviously Almeida, and then obviously I had to do a few interviews, and it was probably worse that like Adam Blythe was doing the interview. I was just, oh mate, like, because he's a good mate, I've known him for a while, and then, you know, he was, I can't remember what he said, but like it just starts getting you a bit emotional. I was just like, oh man, this is hard now. Yeah, did it, got through it, and then I had dope control, and it took me 2.5 hours to go. I was just like, this is just torture now, because then we had to get a cable car down, and then it was like 2 hours to the hotel. And so I spoke to like Max and Sar, whatever, on the phone. That like kills 15 minutes or whatever. And then to be there for another 2 hours, and it's just like, pwah, it's torture.
I mean, there's no good time to lose the Giro by that narrow margin. But is it better for you that you had that experience as a much more experienced, mature rider than if it had happened in your mid-20s, for example?
Yeah, maybe. It's just a bit crap, however old you are, to be honest. But you know, Roglic went through it, like, when was it? 2020?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just the way it goes, isn't it?
I'm interrupting this podcast to remind all listeners to subscribe to Rouleur, the world's finest magazine of cycling and cycling culture. Our latest edition, out now, is Rouleur 123, the Futurology issue. There is some amazing bike tech in Rouleur 123. We went to watch a Sui Aquis being lovingly built. We've got a story about the amazing Canyon Grail. We've got the inside line on the collaboration between BMC and Red Bull Racing. And there's a fantastic story about the Parisian AI Art Collective who decorated the Lapierre frames used by Groupama FDJ in the Tour de France. We also got access to an amazing collection of futuristic time trial bikes from the past, conceived around the time in the early 1990s when TT bike design was suddenly exploding and the bikes looked more futuristic than ever before. There are also stories about the future of the sport. We've looked at the past, present and future of women's time trialing, along with a special feature about how rider scouting is changing. And of course, we've got a range of in-depth interviews with Greg Van Avermaet, Taco van der Hoorn and Jay Vine, all of whom have fascinating perspectives on their careers and the sport. There's also an amazing feature about the Miami Blazers Criterium team, which is essential reading for anyone interested in the future direction of the sport, and much, much more. Rouleur is the world's finest magazine of cycling and cycling culture, and Rouleur 123 is available now. To support our journalism and receive a magazine every 6 weeks, please subscribe. Go to rouleur.cc, hit the subscribe button, and enter the code PODCAST15 to get 15% off our regular subscription price. And now, back to the show.
And how did the rest of the season pan out for you?
Shit.
Is that... right, it's weird. We can stop there. We can talk about your book now if you want.
Yeah, we will in a minute. I was just like... But it feels like it only went well for 3 weeks this year. Like, the main 3 weeks. And then the rest was just like... Well, the build-up was decent, but after that, oh, it was the first time I'd gone for 2 Grand Tours in the same year as well, and that was a massive learning experience. Not that I'm going to use it, because I'm never going to do that again.
that's learning. You've learned that.
Yeah.
So, you've got your new book out, Great Rise According to G. Explain what this book is about and why you've written it.
Well, the reason we wrote it was because I was supposed to retire this year, and I was going to do a book about my career, but I'm not retiring, so... The publishers...
Quickly crank this one out.
Well, no, so the publishers were like, oh, well, we'd really love you to do another book like Mountains. And so me and Tom were chatting and we were like, oh, we don't want it to be like...
That's Tom Fordyce.
Tom Fordyce, who writes it for me, basically. Like, I chat to him. Yeah, but... Look, you've listened to me talk for like, whatever, half an hour. I can't write a book. So we just thought what would be interesting and... Yeah, just try. It's difficult. It's of a fourth book now, which is mad. And like, you don't want to repeat yourself. So try to get some nice routes in there and just like what. And it's, I don't know, it's not just the ride. You know, there's bits that explain the route well, and there's other bits with my memories from racing there or training there and just my experiences and stuff. So it's kind of a way of telling more stories about my career in a different way, really.
Yeah. And it also reminds us that, you know, you're an elite racer. You've won the biggest race in the world. you've been a professional cyclist for a long time now, but in the essence, your life is about riding the bike, and that's what this book is about.
Yeah, and still a fan, basically. Like, I still love bike racing. Like, watching the tour this year, it was hard because I wanted to be there, really. But watching it was also, I don't know, it kind of took me back, like, well, 20 years, and, like, it was a kid again watching it, so still love it, so, yeah.
There's some really great rides through the book. I just want to take issue that the first line of the prologue, you said, you never feel worse after a bike ride. I'll just say, Geraint, I'm not a Tour de France winner. Yeah, we're not all Tour de France winners. Sometimes we do feel quite physically tired after after a bike ride. But just explain what you mean there.
Yeah, just more the mentality, really. Like, for instance, the main thing that I'm thinking about there is when you go out in this crappy weather, it's raining and it's or whatever, and but you still get your kit on and you go out, you do it, and you come back and, yeah, you might be freezing and you might get hypothermia, but you recover from it. And then, but afterwards, you're like, oh, yeah, no, that was good, you know? Like, once you've warmed up, and not the hypothermia bit, but once you've warmed up and, like, you've done it, you feel that sense of achievement. And, like, now, for instance, after this time off the bike, you just start to feel so lethargic and just lack a bit of energy, really. Like, but once you start training and you get a bit of consistency, and you just feel so much more rejuvenated after a bit of exercise, a bit of a sweat, and top of the world.
Do you have a preference between racing and riding? Do you prefer one to the other? I spoke to Lizzie Deignan yesterday, and she says she definitely prefers racing to riding. What's your perspective on
that? Yeah, 100%. I think I still love riding, but training is different to riding. And you train to race. And you train that hard and you put all that hard graft in and, you know, the diet and all the restrictions to go well in the race, really. And it's all about the racing. So, yeah, for me, it'd be the racing is the... But then there's nothing worse than when it's going bad as well. You don't you'd rather be anywhere else.
Yeah. And what would you say your favourite ride is?
It depends what you want to do. Like, if it's going to be a long ride and in the mountains, and then, you know, somewhere in the south of France is great. Then if it's just like a ride to the pub with your mates, then, you know, Cardiff is ideal. Or then, you know, if a coffee ride, you know, a nice Aussie calf down in Australia somewhere. So I think wherever you are, it's always something good about it.
Yeah. And you've mentioned that your home rides around Monaco, you're quite keen to promote those, especially to the cyclists who live in Andorra.
Yeah, definitely.
There's a bit of a rivalry between the Monaco cycling community and that in Andorra. So tell me a bit more about that.
Well, you know Tupac and Biggie? It's a similar thing. It's just massive beef between Andorra and Monaco. And there's just no contest in my eyes. Like, Andorra's 3 hours to an airport. You're up a mountain. You can't ride there half the year. Alex Dowsett's here somewhere, isn't he? Mate, he'd have to admit that Monaco was the place to be. Yeah. Sun all, like, 300 days a year, whatever. Good roads. Like, the reason I went there, obviously, you got the tax benefits, whatever, but...
Like, okay, next question.
Not going to beat about the bush, you are. But the main reason I honestly went there was because Froome and Richie Porte were living there. The team was setting up a little base, and for me, it was like, well, I've got to move out of Cardiff anyway, because you can't train for the Tour de France in Cardiff. You could, but you're not gonna win it anyway. So, you know, it's warm down there. You got the climbs, and then chasing those two rounds, you know, just learning from them and everything. So, and then the airport's half an hour away. So,
yeah, well, a victory for Monaco. As well as writing books, you've been podcasting. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I started in the Tour. I don't know when it was now, maybe 19. And Luke came up with the idea. He was like, oh, why don't we just start a podcast? And I was like, yeah, if we do that, then we won't have to do interviews after stages. Didn't work. I thought we could just say what we wanted and then, yeah, just listen to podcasts, mate. But then, yeah, it's been great. It's just been, for me as well, I was thinking, oh, yeah, possibly, you know, when you stop, it could prepare you a bit for, like, media stuff or whatever. And, yeah, then obviously the one with Tom Fordyce started as well, the club, the Geraint Thomas Cycling Club, which runs alongside it, but it's just totally different. You know, with Tom, it's a lot more slick and professional. With Luke, it's just turn up and, like, what are we talking about, mate?
And, you know, the point of it and what I love about it is the fact it's basically unfiltered, and I can't believe the stuff that you say on it.
I know, neither can the team sometimes. Like, there's Jean, the PR dude from the team's here today, and... some of the times I just message him once a new one's out. It's like, oh, what do you think of that one? It's like, yeah, it's okay, like, but maybe steer clear of that a bit more. But no, like, to be fair to the team, they're really good with it. They they know what we're like and they're happy for us to do it. And a lot of it is tongue-in-cheek, but that gets lost in translation quite a lot. But what can we do about that, eh?
Yeah. So you've been a pro for 17 years. You're getting towards the end of your career and you're in your mid-30s. Cycling has changed a lot. It's always changed a lot. It just seems like the speed of change has really been accelerating the last three or four
COVID,
years.
COVID, yeah.
It looks harder and harder than ever to compete. There are kids showing up in their late teens who are able to compete with the best. So what's your perspective on that? How do you keep your motivation? How do you improve enough to kind of keep up to speed with the best?
That's what motivates me. It's like seeing kids really, isn't it? But young guys coming up and being good. And like, I'm just like, wow, I'm not ready to stop yet. It motivates me to keep improving and keep pushing. And, you know, all this innovation, like at least, you know, trying to not stay ahead of the curve because we're behind Jumbo now, but like really keep improving and pushing. And that motivates me. It's just so intense now. And I think for me, the way I am, like, I think I can still be competitive if I target one thing. If I try and do a year, do you remember the World Cup?
Yeah.
With that jersey. It's great, great jersey.
Yeah, so the season-long one-day competition, wasn't it?
Yeah, so it was like 10 one-day races throughout the year, and they all added up to win the World Cup, basically. And if I was to do something like that, there's absolutely no chance I would be able to do that. But one big hit, you know, whether it be a Grand Tour or one day, then I'm still confident I can be there with the best and, you know, while winning. And that's what I love to do, and that's what I want to keep doing, really.
And what's it like racing against people like Pogacar, Van der Poel, Van Aert, who kind of changed the way the races, you know, unfold?
It's annoying. It's hard. But at the same time, it is enjoyable and it's a massive challenge. And I think, especially like, you know, 20 years down the line, you know, when these guys have won, you know, probably rivaling Mercs with the big races they've won. So to be racing with them now will be, I'm sure I'll look back fondly at it, but at least I try and beat them every now and again.
Yeah. And speaking of one big hit of targets, what's your 2024 going to look like?
Yeah, that's a big question. I don't know really. For me, the Giro looks good. You know, it's not super steep climbs. There's two long TTs. You know, there's a gravel day. You know, I've been 10th or 11th in Strada, but I've only done it twice. But yeah, so that's exciting. And that's after what happened this year, it'd be nice to go back and give it another go. But then I won one the Mr. Tour again, and it finishes in Nice. The last stage is a time trial from Monaco. You go up the mountain down into Nice, which that would be class to do.
You could do both.
You could do both. But, well, yeah, potentially could go for the Giro and then help the younger guys in the Tour be more of a, well, be there in the end for them, but also just help them. But I'm not one to talk a lot, you know, just kind of just lead by example almost. But, you know, we've got Carlos, Tom, a lot of young guys who are developing potentially, but I'm just thinking out loud now, you know, but don't quote me on this. Then there's a classics. I love to do the classics at some point, but yeah, I don't know. It's one of the started talking to the team. By the time we get to training camp, we'll have a better idea.
Yeah, the Puncher guys did want to know, actually, the guys who made the classic.
They asked me as well. They asked you,
when are we going to see you at the classics again?
I have to go back before I stop because Flanders is probably my favourite race out of everything. It's just, I just remember, as I was growing up, we'd travel over to Belgium as a junior to race over there, and watching those guys and those races is just, yeah, it seems like the proper hard men and of the sport and great races to watch, so.
Yeah. Okay, right. Thanks very much, Geraint. So you can get hold of Geraint's book at all good bookstores, probably bad bookstores as well, but focus on the good bookstores. Geraint, I think you've been one of the iconic British racing figures of the last 17 years. You know, you've won the Tour de France, you've won Olympic gold medals, you come second in the Giro and hopefully first next year, and you've won all kinds of races. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on stage. You're really entertaining. I love your podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together for Geraint Thomas. Cheers, mate.
You have been listening to Ruler Conversations. Ruler Conversations is made by the editorial staff of Ruler Magazine. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Ruler and on Instagram at Ruler Magazine, or visit our website at ruler.cc. This edition of Ruler Conversations was produced by Joseph Perry of Content is Queen.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.